Hello and welcome back to the Sam T. Blues Review here on 97.7 The Bolt. Joining me now is a fantastic singer, songwriter, TV producer, comedian, a little bit of everything, and that is Tracy Newman. Tracy, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm excellent, thank you. It's very exciting for me to be talking with you today.
Really? I have to figure out why. Maybe I'll figure that out as we go along.
Yeah. Well, I started listening to you. Are you still with the Reinforcements?
No, I disbanded my band. I don't know how else to say that.
Yeah, I guess that sounds bad any way you say that.
Right. I didn't fire people. I just decided I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do. You know, having a band is, as people out there who are bosses of anything. You know, on a daily basis, it's very wearing. It's hard, you know, to tell people what to do all the time. And I mean, you know, in business, it's one thing, but with a band, it's friends usually. And
of course.
But you're still the leader. So I don't know. It was starting to wear on me.
Yeah, I can understand that. But yeah, I started listening to you guys when I was in high school. So that was about 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you hear us? I had CDs out, but it's not like I didn't have a record promoter.
I was and still am a fan of your sister, Lorraine Newman. Just kind of, I think I liked her on either MySpace or Facebook, whatever was the bigger one at the time. So then I just kind of, in a roundabout way, discovered your music, and I, you know, really liked it, obviously.
Uh-huh.
That's
cool. That's exciting to hear.
Well, I'm glad. So, yeah, because I was like listening to different genres of music, and I was mostly kind of like a classic rock guy when I was in high school, but then I wanted to kind of get into more kind of folk, more roots music, and I know that's kind of what you were doing and continue to do.
Yeah.
And was that kind of music kind of always around when you were growing up?
Yeah, I started playing guitar when I was about 14, guitar and banjo and kind of anything I could get my hands on.
Sure.
That you could carry. I never learned the piano because you can't, you know, I mean, nowadays you can carry it easier than you used to be able to. I got pretty good on the guitar, really. And I had relatives, like, they weren't really cousins. I guess it was uncles and aunts that were kind of hanging around with the people in the 60s, you know, that were performing, late 50s and 60s. And so I was around that.
Sure.
And, you know, the Kingston Trio and the Limelighters and people like that were, groups like that were forming and were popular. And their music was easy, especially the Kingston Trio. It was really easy to play all that stuff, and because it was big hits and it was so exciting,
right?
You know, you wanted to learn all those three chord songs, and so I became, you know, when you're that age, when you're young, you're just like a sponge.
Come gather around and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. So if your time to you is worth saving, then you'd better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. But the times, they are a change. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen. Keep your eyes wide, the chance will come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a change.
So when did you decide, you know, you wanted to actually pursue that as a career, to be a musician?
Well, you know, when you're a teenager or even late teens, usually, you know, you get these crazy ideas like that you want to be a performer. And, you know, your parents are totally against it because they know that it's impossible to make a living, which is, unless you're a star, it's pretty true.
Sure.
And but I decided that that's what I was going to do because I guess I thought I was pretty good. My parents didn't see it. They weren't interested in that kind of music, though. You know, they were very, it's like, I think all parents reject the for the most part, reject the music their kids are listening to.
Yeah.
And I remember they used to think that, you know, they'd talk about Bob Dylan and say, I can't understand the word he's saying, you know. And they were raised, you know, with Sinatra. Not that I wasn't. I was, too. But, I mean, they came up at the same time he did. You know, they were the same age. And, you know, he's very clear, and his phrasing is great, and he's concentrating on singing, whereas Bob Dylan wasn't concentrating on singing. If you go back and look at those videotapes from early 60s, Bob Dylan was clear as a bell.
Right.
I mean, you can really understand every word before he started to be a rock musician.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what they were talking about. It was really that they couldn't listen to his voice.
Hmm.
And, you know, we were all emulating that kind of singing. So I'm sure it was horrible. It was torture for my parents. You know.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I know your parents, did they just want you to go to college and kind of get like a, what did they want you to get into if you weren't doing that?
Yeah, I mean, the popular thing back then was liberal arts, which is,
right.
You know, essentially not really anything. I mean, it's like you can go to anything that was in that category. And, you know, I was writing a little bit back then, writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
Studied to become a dental assistant, which is different than, you know, you don't have to be a nurse. You don't have to
right.
really go to school for it. You just go to a, you know, some sort of class where you, I don't know, you end up being able to be hired by a dentist as an assistant, which is not the same thing as a hygienist.
Right.
You know, and so I did. I actually worked for a dentist for a while.
Hmm.
You know what? I didn't mind it. I kind of enjoyed it. I wore a nurse's outfit, which was fun. And, you know, I assisted in operations and stuff.
How did your parents then feel about your sister's path?
Well, you know, I was in the Groundlings, and Lorraine joined the Groundlings and was snatched from the Groundlings right away by Lorne Michaels. So it looked like Lorraine was going to be successful right away. So they liked it.
Yeah. Obviously, I wasn't around for any of that, but it seems like that was quick, like that whole Saturday Night Live cast where they just kind of were kind of stars overnight. Was that kind of Lorraine's experience?
Well, you know, they were called the Not Ready for Primetime Players.
Right.
I guess they still are. But Chevy and John Belushi and Danny Aykroyd and Lorraine and Gilda and Jane Curtin and Garrett Morris were all plucked from different companies, and because Lorne had seen them all, right? And he brought them together. But the show was stars, and this was just the group kind of backing them up in various mm-hmm. ways, in some cases doing backup singing, and in many cases doing sketches with them. And it took that whole year, the first year, maybe 6 months of that, or I don't know how long, but it took a while before the show became the Not Ready for Primetime Players.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
But
it didn't happen overnight, no.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Speaking of Groundlings, so you are a founding member of the Groundlings. So was comedy kind of always something you liked, or did you kind of try to supplement comedy with music?
It sort of just happened.
Sure.
You know, I went to New York in the mid-60s, and I would perform at the Bitter End and various other clubs, and after that, I would go to the Improv. You know, the original Improv, which was on 44th and 9th, was the place that all the performers in town would go when they finished their gig. So things started happening there around midnight and went till about 4 a.m. They didn't sell alcohol there at the time. It was just a coffee house. So what I would do there was I would sing, when I would get up and perform, I would sing, I worked out a Beatles medley. And, you know, this was like 1965 when that was like, not only was the music incredibly exciting and hot, not that it ever stopped being exciting and hot, but it was very, very fresh. And here's this young girl playing the guitar, you know, and I wore a little cap and boots and I had a little outfit, and I just kind of imitated the Beatles. And, you know, did their stuff. And so that was they were very receptive, even though most of the people at the Improv at that time were not singing. I was probably the only regular singer. But I was hanging around all these comics.
Yeah.
You know, Rodney Dangerfield was there, and Richard Pryor, and Robert Klein, and they all were, you know, in their own way, they were brilliant.
Right.
And it was just an incredibly exciting time. So I saw improv there for the first time, especially song improv.
Yeah.
Robert Klein used to get up and do, you know, make up songs, and I just couldn't believe it.
You wrote me so many letters telling me me so many lies. If I only knew then what I know now.
Obviously, you've had just, I mean, incredible success in comedy. You've written for Cheers, The Nanny, The Drew Carey Show, and then, of course, the famous episode of The Ellen DeGeneres Show when she came out as gay. How did that feel? I can't imagine to be such a huge part of TV history like that.
It's 1996 or 7.
Right.
And it isn't that there hadn't been gay characters on shows. There had been, but the lead had never been gay.
Mm.
And not only that, it wasn't just that she was gay, but that she was a woman.
Sure.
So the word lesbian had to start being used now and then. And the word lesbian was just so taboo back then. It was a remarkably exciting time, as you can imagine. And, you know, I think we all had a bit of an awareness that we were part of history. You know, my partner and I were just fortunate enough to be the people that the network and the studio chose to write that episode.
Yeah. How do you tackle something like that? How do you write it? I mean, I'm assuming that a lot of that has to come from Ellen and kind of her personal experiences, right?
Yeah. Actually, Ellen pitched the whole story.
Hmm.
And I think we changed one thing. My partner and I were on staff there, and we had been for four seasons, and so we really knew how to write for her, and they gave us time off to write it. And, you know, writing a sitcom, it's like 22 minutes of comedy you're writing.
Right.
And so, you know, they gave us probably 2 months. I think we had to come into work 2 days a week.
Wow.
And so the rest of the time we were meeting in our office and writing the script. And we had so much time to really make sure that we were comfortable with what we were presenting.
And I think that's hard to do sometimes, especially with a comedy, because you want it to feel sincere. You know, you want to get a message across. I mean, you want people to laugh, but you don't want people to, you don't want it to be like a caricature, you know what I mean?
Right. Oh, I totally know what you mean.
Yeah.
And, you know, sitcom, you know, if you watch a lot of sitcoms, you know that some of them are really over the top and fake, and you know, there's a laugh track, and it's really, it's hard to take. But The Ellen Show didn't have a laugh track, and it was pretty honest. And this episode was particularly honest, because it's not just that we write it. My partner and I write the script, and then we throw it open to the room of writers, including Ellen, if she wants to come in, and they kind of have at it. As funny as we made it, it was like way funnier when the room got done with it.
So another show that I have to talk to you about is According to Jim, and it's honestly one of my favorite shows. I'm a big Jim Belushi fan. Tell me how that came about. How did that idea come about, making a show for him?
First of all, I'm glad to hear that you're a Jim Belushi fan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because at the beginning of his career, when he started to become well-known, there were the John Belushi, diehard Belushi fans. Because when you say Belushi, people think of John.
Right,
You know, you and I think of Jim.
Yeah.
People were irritated. They felt that Jim Belushi was riding on his brother's coattails.
Yeah, I don't think he ever had a fair shot early on, which is unfortunate.
No, he really didn't. It's very unfortunate because we chose him for this show because he was the best person for us. We started watching his movies, and he's just really good. He's a really, really, really solid comedy performer and probably a better actor than John was. So, you know, it was at the beginning anyway, just a pure pleasure writing for him. It was terrific. I mean, you know, as with every show, if there's a star that's irreplaceable, something happens in these shows that, you know, they once they realize they can't be replaced, they start to make demands, and it gets to be very tough. Personalities start to be, whatever the person really is, starts to come out.
Right.
Or, you know, it's like power corrupts, and, you know, there's very few people I worked with. Like Ted Danson was a guy that was always a sweetheart. Same with Bob Newhart. But all the other stars I worked with, there were times when, you know, it was just like, oh my God, what's happened to this person? You know, but I don't know how they don't get that way.
I don't know.
You know, the demands on them, they're exhausted.
What did you work with Bob Newhart on?
There was a show called Bob. After Cheers, we left Cheers. We didn't do the final season of Cheers. We were only there. It was our first show. We were on the 10th season. And then the people who were executive producing left Cheers and took us with them to create a show for Bob Newhart.
Hmm.
And it was his last comedy, and it was called Bob. and he was a cartoonist. It was amazing to work with somebody like Bob Newhart, who had been around for so long.
Oh, I can imagine.
And yeah, you know, when you're working on these shows, you're pitching a lot of jokes on the floor during the taping. Like if a joke isn't working, everybody huddles together and comes up with a better joke. The thing about Bob Newhart is that he would come up to one of the writers on the floor, and when he saw that a joke wasn't working, and he would say, instead of saying this, how about if I say this? And he would have the fix.
There you go.
And, you know, it was the easiest star I ever worked for in that respect, because he just knew his rhythm so well.
After According to Jim ended, that you made that choice to focus on music full time?
Well, I'm going to be brutally honest.
Do it.
That show ran for 8 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Before we sold it, my partner and I were going to break up. We were going to stop. I was going to stop writing television.
Oh, really?
I was 10 years older than him. And I was not really burned out of writing for television, but I was tired of going to an office, you know, having to be somewhere every day. Even though it's television, which, by the way, is a very exciting job. But you're there at 10 o'clock in the morning, but you don't know when you're going to go home.
Sure.
And I had a daughter, and I, you know, from the time she was 6 until she was late teens, I mean, I was there in the morning for her, but almost never there at night except the weekend. And that was very rough. I just had had it, even though by then she was a teenager. And I mean, I could have continued with According to Jim, but I just had decided I was going to quit. And I was 62. So that's another thing. I thought, if I'm ever going to go back to being a singer-songwriter, 62 is already a joke, you know. Where am I going to play? But I knew I had this skill.
Right.
And I hadn't been able to. I used it, you know, as a TV writer, I wrote a lot of songs for television. I thought, you know, I would like to study songwriting, you know, like in Nashville. And here, there's a wonderful songwriting teacher, Harriet Schock. You probably don't remember. She had a hit record in, I think, 1975. The song was That Ain't No Way to Treat a Lady.
That ain't no way to treat.
She had written that song, plus a number of other songs that were covered by big artists. And she's been teaching for years in California and Los Angeles, and she's just the best songwriting teacher that is out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying with her, and I don't know, I just started playing in little clubs for, you know, 10 people and a dog, and just kept doing it. I just thought, what have I got to lose? I just get out there and I just get better and better and better. And then people started to sing harmony from the audience, and then I'd bring them up. And two of the people that I did that with ended up in my band. And a bass player who was with Harry Belafonte for 35 years.
Oh, wow.
Saw me somewhere and just asked if he could join the band. And so he joined, and I got a drummer. And, you know, we just worked for about 10, off and on for about 10 years together. But, you know, given the fact that I started when I was 62, I was starting to get tired. So that, you know, I drifted into writing songs for children because, why did I really do? Well, you know, my daughter got married. I kind of knew there'd be kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just drifted into writing songs for children, which, by the way, I had been doing when I was in my 20s.
I was going to ask you about that. Was that around the time when you were in your 20s that you were on that PBS special?
Yeah, I did it. It wasn't a special. It was a series called What's New, and it was for children, and it was all different subjects, but they hired me to do 6 half-hour episodes of folk music for children.
Wow.
And so I did, you know, stuff like instruments from all over the world. So I had to kind of learn to play the banjo. And I had to learn, I mean, I already knew how to play, but I had to really learn it well for one song at least. And then I had to learn, like, at least be able to display the steel drum. You know, I mean, I just got a hold of a lot of instruments, and in some cases I could play them, in some cases I couldn't at all. And then I also got folk songs from all over the world. And I wrote the 6 half half-hour shows. I was like 23. There, then I somehow got a hold of those tapes, early, like in 2015, and started to look through them. And I, you know, because of YouTube, you can post stuff like this. And the quality of these tapes is remarkable.
I was going to mention that.
Beautiful. So I posted a whole bunch of them. And as I mentioned to you, one of them yesterday broke 500,000 hits. Well,
that's...
you know, imagine my surprise.
Oh, I know. That's incredible. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. It is. It is unbelievable, you know. And, of course, you know, there's people like, you know, what's you doing today? Because they know that that's from 1965. So all of a sudden they're looking at my stuff today. And, you know, I'm sort of, some of them were probably disappointed because it's probably guys who look at me and think I'm cute and then realize, oh, my God, she's in her 70s. What's going on here?
I think people know basic math. I don't think they're going to be that disappointed or angry.
Have you noticed this instrument over here that looks like a frying pan on a big stick? Well... that's a banjo, of course. And it's a five-string banjo. That means it's got five strings. And notice where the fifth string starts, way up here. So if I form the chords up here, then this string isn't included. See? This instrument can be so loud that I put a towel in the back to soften it. The strings on the banjo are made of steel, and this part is made of parchment, which is the paper that many of our first books were written on. A lot of people use finger picks when they play the banjo, but I don't because I do a lot of strumming. Now I'm going to play a song called Cripple Creek because it's a very good banjo tune if I can get through it.
To check out your music, you do have that YouTube channel, and then I know your website, you have some CDs on there as well if people wanted to grab.
Yeah, my website's just tracynewman.com. All my children's stuff, which I love, is companies called Run Along Home. It's based on a song, actually. But it's runalonghome.com. But you can find that even through tracynewman.com. And then also the YouTube, just, you know, if you go to YouTube and type in Tracy Newman, you'll get a variety of things.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to see the shows from 1965, that show was called What's New. And that's really fun, especially that song, Cripple Creek.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Hammering away on the banjo and that. that's fun to watch. I even like watching that, which is pretty amazing because, you know, you usually don't like to watch yourself that much. But I'm enjoying it. And I'm far removed from my 23-year-old self.
There you go. Well, yeah. Tracy, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Yeah, no problem at all.
And this was a pleasure for me.
I'm glad to hear that. Have a good one.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.
Home, isn't the sound of it lonely? Long, oh, isn't it empty and cold? Doesn't it kill you and break your heart when alone seems to be what you are? When I had you, I was filled with love and I was a fire in the night. I was the air.